Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Well, apparently, despite my best efforts, I did not manage to run anybody off Sunday morning. I tried, and apparently I just couldn't offend anybody, and the email has been overwhelmingly positive as a result. But I have to read you something that has nothing to do with any of that. Every once in a while, I just do a search on my name on the internet to see who's talking about me or what they're saying. And sometimes it's kind of surprising because things I've written, theological articles, that kind of stuff, end up on these chat groups. And somebody will cite me to support their argument toward or against a particular position. And, you know, as Jim McLarty from Grace Christian Assembly, Salvation by Grace says, and they'll throw a quote out there. And so I check every once in a while to see what people are saying about me. Well, at the same time, most of you know that back in the early 80s, I had a rock and roll career going. And even up until last year, I still had CDs being released from things I had done in the early 80s. So last year, we had an album, a CD released called Greatest Hits Live. And just June 2nd, 2007, a new review showed up on the internet on that CD. And this is just too amusing. First, he just talks about the band a little bit, and I think, unfortunately, this reviewer thinks that the band is still together because CDs keep coming out. But it's new material of old stuff. It's just stuff that hadn't been released that's finally being released. And so this guy thinks that we're still an active band. And then he did a search on me and apparently came up with some rather startling results that he had to incorporate into his review. And that's what I found really funny. 707, that was the name of my band, have their roots firmly planted in the early 80s. While they may not be as well known as some of the other hair bands of the time, they did quickly develop a loyal and devoted fan base. The band was comprised of Kevin Russell playing lead guitar and acting as the vocal frontman. Phil Bryant is on bass and offers up his vocal talents. Jim McLarty is drummer, and last but by no means least is the very adaptable Todd Howarth, who seems equally at home on the guitar as the keyboards. As to musical style, you can sum up the group in two words, hard rock, and I do mean hard. I suspect that they are quite spectacular live. I suspect that they are. See, it's all present tense, and this was just written a couple weeks ago, so he seems to think we're still out there. Maybe the strangest and most incongruous member of this band is Jim McLarty, who, according to online sources, when not pushing the Marshall amps into meltdown mode, is actually a pastor in a small town outside of Nashville. So now my two internet lives, my rock and roll life and my theological life, are starting to congeal on website reviews of the music that's coming out. I found that very funny. The most incongruous member of the band is the one who's also a pastor outside of Nashville. Anyway, he concludes by saying, 707 are an outstanding example of the hard rock genre. However, they never quite made it to the top of the pile, to say the least. It was a crowded field, and with so many other bands competing, somehow they got lost in the crowd, which is a shame, because this is a band that deserves to be listened to and seen live. Look, you can't see the band live. The band hasn't played live since 1982, and I, myself, am just barely alive. And so I'm not playing drums anywhere, and you can't go watch me incongruously. Would that be it? You can't watch me melt down Marshall amps anymore. That's not going to happen. So, anyway, I just thought that was really fun.
I'd like to see drums played through a Marshall amp. Oh, yeah,
we have a reunion. Playing drums through a melted down Marshall amp. That's right. That's what I was doing. You know, I've been asked a few times the last few years whether I'd be willing to get together with the other guys and do a where are they now kind of get together and play thing. And I just laugh. I just, no. There's no way, no, that is just not going to happen. Here's the problem, I don't even own drums, any less play them anymore.
Details.
And I used to play them rather voraciously, so it's just funny. All right, we're in Genesis 34. When we finished up last week, we had talked about Jacob as an example of being gracious because God had been gracious to him. When we last saw him, Jacob had settled in Shechem, and he was surrounded with Canaanite folk who lived in that area, but he was making peace with them, and of course he was a very wealthy and powerful man, and so the folks who lived in Shechem wanted to make agreements and deals with him because it was very clear that God was on his side and supported him, so he didn't really want to go up against him, and after all, this is the same fellow whose grandfather had, with a standing army of 300 men, gone in and beat the way out of the kings of the plain. And so this family has a history of being strong with God and strong in numbers and powerful folk. But now some treachery is going to happen here in chapter 34, an ugly story from the Old Testament here of difficulty between the brothers. As you know, there are 12 brothers who are the sons of Jacob, and then there's one daughter, Dinah. And so as you might expect, all of the brothers watch out for Dinah. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land, the surrounding area of Shechem. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. A little late, it seems to me. After you have lain with her by force, then you start the tender talk.
Seems
a tad late. Yes, that after he had done it, he then began saying, but I love you and now I want you to be mine.
The implication is he took her by force.
Yes, that he raped her. That's the implication, yes. Wow. And that becomes more clear when you see how the brothers react. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this young girl for a wife. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. But his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. When Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him, the sons of Jacob came in from the field, and when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. So this appears to be, he may have genuinely cared for her, liked her, desired her, but this also seems like a way to make up for it. It's like, well, I'm going to marry her now, so that makes things better, right? The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. Now, you may recall that so far in the book of Genesis, when Jacob and Esau both went and began marrying and having children, that Esau was the first to take wives, and the first two wives he took were local Canaanite women. And you may recall how his mother went to his dad and said, it grieves me that he has married these two women. So they were very specific to send Jacob back to Ur of the Chaldees, back to the land of their family, so that there wouldn't be this kind of intermarriage with the people of the land who God was going to ultimately drive out when he gave the land to the descendants of Abraham. So they're trying to keep it within the family, and now this guy, a Canaanite, is trying to force his way into the family and saying, let's intermarry together, which is opposite of everything you've seen from the Abraham lineage this far. Intermarry with us. Give us your daughters and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you will live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it and acquire property in it. It seems like an interesting kind of come on, doesn't it? Trade and live here and acquire property here. Who does that property ultimately belong to anyway?
Israel.
It's their property anyway. God has already told them, you're going to get all this land. But Shechem and Hamor, they believe that, well, this is our land, and maybe we can make a deal where we can trade some property with them, not realizing that the property is going to ultimately end up in Jacob's hands anyway. Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, if I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. So I'll give you the big dowry. Whatever it is you want for her, I'll give it to you. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according to all that you say to me, but give me the girl in marriage. But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit and spoke to them because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us." That is one of the signs of all the descendants, the male descendants of Abraham, is that they would be circumcised. So they're using circumcision at this point as their rationale for saying, we can't give you to her. But Moses is very clear to point out right at the top here, they're going to do this deceitfully. They're going to trick these guys.
They don't think there's any way they'll do it?
No, they're not going to do it. This is a deceitful trick they're pulling. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing and give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you. If you will become like us, in that every male of you will be circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you, and we will become one people." Now, this is advantageous to the folks at Hamor. Remember, Jacob came back with companies and companies of people and herds and flocks. He was a very wealthy man. So if they're going to start intermarrying, they become a force to be reckoned with in that area. They become more powerful against their enemies. They have more wealth to deal with. So this is really advantageous to them. But it also means that Hamor and Shechem have to go back to their entire household, everyone over whom they rule, and explain to them that in order for the son here to have a wife, all the males have to be circumcised. I would like to see how they talked everybody into that one. I mean, that had to be a really compelling speech. To go back, we won't tell people what Tom's reaction was. But to tell all the males, look, we all have to be circumcised in order that my son can be married. Boy, that's some loyalty there.
They were also going to get some women.
Yes, and you're going to get women, and you're going to become wealthier. There are advantages. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will go. Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So verse 19, the young men did not delay to do the thing because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city, and they spoke to the men of the city, saying, "These men are friendly with us. Therefore, let them live in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us must be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours?" See what the motivation is? We'll get all their stuff. All we got to do is go through with the circumcision thing. So let's agree to do that, and then we end up with all their wealth. Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us. Verse 24, and all who went out of the gate of the city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Now it came about on the third day, when all the men were in pain, while all the men were in pain, two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unaware and killed every male. So it was treachery from the beginning. And by the way, Simeon and Levi would have been two of the sons who were born to the same mother. Same mom, same dad. A real family connection in a way that even Joseph wouldn't have been connected to Dinah. They would have shared a dad, but not a mom. These are Leah's children. It's Leah's daughter. It's Leah's sons. So Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unaware and killed every male. And they killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword, and they took Dinah from Shechem's house, and they went forth. Jacob's sons came upon the slain, and they looted the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys, and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and they captured and they looted all the wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in their houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men, being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" So there's a lot going on here. First off, Jacob, whose name has been changed to Israel, has been told that he's going to get the birthright of his father, and in the next chapter, as he goes to Bethel, God is going to show up and promise him the Abrahamic covenant, which includes all the land. But remember, when he left Bethel the first time, God spoke to him there and said, "I'll be with you, and I'm going to take you to your father's land, and I'm going to make you rich, and I'm going to bring you back here to Bethel, and nothing's going to hurt you, nothing's going to get you, I'm going to take care of you." And so people will say, well, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, as a direct result of the fact that Jacob was the good one and Esau was the bad one. And since God knew that Jacob was going to be the good and faithful one and Esau was going to be the bad and troublesome, quarrelsome one, that's the reason God said, "Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated." Last week, we saw Esau be the peacemaker. Remember, Jacob sent all his flocks and his herds and his gifts and his wife and his children, everybody ahead of him, in the hope that by the time he got to Esau, Esau's heart would be softer and Esau would not kill him. And by the time he got there, Esau said, "I don't want anything that's yours." Fell on his neck, hugged him, kissed him. And they cried together for being joined together after 20 years. I think if you look at that story, you'd have to say, well, turns out Esau was kind of the good guy in that story, wasn't he? And then now you've got Jacob, who has a promise right from God, "I'm going to bring you back to Bethel, and I'm going to protect you." And now that his sons have defended Dinah, look what his concern is. As soon as the Canaanites and the Perizzites hear about this and hear that we tricked the people of Shechem and that you went in and slew them and then we looted them, they're all going to gang up on me and come and kill me. Where is the faith here? Again, you don't see Jacob being the good one. You don't see Jacob being the faithful one. You don't see Jacob being the one that you could justifiably say, well, of course God would say, "Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. Look at Jacob. He's the good one. He's the faithful one. He's the loyal one. No wonder God would like him. And no wonder he rejected Esau. Esau, bad guy." It's not the way it plays out. It turns out that they both have their highlights and they both have their problems. And that's why it's so important in Romans 9 that Paul said that the reason that God said, "Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated," that he said it while the children were still in the womb so that the election by grace would stand, not according to works.
Where do they come off thinking that this is some sort of fair retribution? Yeah. This is pretty. I could see if someone came in and wiped out a village of theirs that they'd respond this way. This is really
Well, it is to a degree, but also remember that there is this blood purity going on. If this rape had produced a child, she being the only female in the whole group, think of the problems that were caused just because Abraham went in the tent with Hagar. I mean, all of these Canaanites that they're having to deal with that are in that land are descendants of Esau. These are all Esauites, and these are all Edomites, and these are all the descendants of Abraham in the tent with Hagar produced Ishmael. These are all Ishmaelites. See, what my problem is now is that I have sometimer's disease. I don't have Alzheimer's disease because it doesn't happen all the time. It just happens sometimes. So I've decided I have sometimer's. Like right then, I just couldn't come up with that name. So anyway, yes, they have had other events like this that have produced offspring that have been a problem to them for the rest of their history. marrying within the family was a very, very important thing. So it's really much more than just that it was a rape. It was also a rape of the only girl who is a descendant, the next generation descendant of Abraham. So I think there's a lot at work here. And so that takes us to chapter 35. Then God said to Jacob, arise and go to Bethel. This is the completion of a cycle. He was on his way leaving the promised land to go to the land of his fathers to go look for a wife. When he laid his head down on a rock, slept on that rock, saw a ladder with angels descending and ascending on it, saw God standing above it, and that place was called Bethel, house of God. And so he made a vow to God there and said, if you return me to this place, I will give you a tenth of everything I acquire between the time I leave and come back. And God is keeping that vow. God has said to him, you're on your way back to Bethel. I'll meet you at Bethel. We're headed for Bethel. He's going to go back to that same place because God is reminding him that before he ever left, God showed up and said, you're mine, you're going to get the covenant, you're going to get this land, and I'm going to take care of you, and I'm going to return you to this place. So now God is driving him back to that place. Despite Jacob's faithlessness, God is nevertheless driving him back to that same place because God is faithful, God is consistent, God keeps his word. And what's going to happen when he gets to Bethel? God is going to repeat the Abrahamic covenant and say it now belongs to Jacob. So we're going to see a principle established here, which is that Abraham, of course, was the first recipient of everything that entails the Abrahamic covenant. But then we saw Isaac, and then we saw God speak to Isaac and say to Isaac, this is the covenant I made with your father Abraham, and now I make it with you. And he gave him all the details of it again. Now he's going to say it to Jacob in chapter 35. Repeat the Abrahamic covenant and say, now I've given it to you. And the principle at work here is that the Abrahamic covenant is moving generation to generation, and God is picking specific people, in this case, the younger of the two, the one who shouldn't have gotten the birthright. God is, by his grace, by his election, picking the recipients of the Abrahamic covenant. And it's very important to know that because once we get to where the Abrahamic covenant goes after Jacob, understanding what happens when he passes it down to his sons will help you understand an intrinsic part of Old Testament Israelology that the vast, vast, vast majority of the church world doesn't get. And so I'm really being very careful and very pedantic here to point out this principle that the Abrahamic covenant is moving generation to generation to particular individuals. Got that? Yes.
Well, and in keeping with that, as you pointed out, he makes promises to people and then they show that they're a bunch of foolish acting people. He not only has a bunch of murderers under him, but they're all idol. They're still fooling with idols here and earrings and all sorts of things.
That's the next thing he has to do is tell everybody to get rid of their idols.
So aren't they being rewarded for being faithful?
Right. No, they're not being rewarded for being faithful. God's being faithful. Well, you may recall that when they left Laban's house, Rachel grabbed one of her father's idols and hid it from him when he came chasing after them and saying, somebody stole my idols. And so she stuck it in with all of the camel's saddles and blankets and stuff, and then sat down on it so that her dad wouldn't lift it and look at it. So there are idols in the camp of Jacob as he's moving and as he's living in Shechem, and of course all the people that he has acquired from Laban. Let's think backwards yet again. We're talking about people who are the family and lineage of Abraham. Abraham's father was an idol maker. All right? When Abraham was in Ur of the Chaldees, he was an idol worshiper, and God came and called him. So it's not surprising that when they would go back to the family of Laban and then get servants from Laban, of course they'd be idol worshipers. And so he has to clear out the idols before he gets to Bethel, the house of God. Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and live there, and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. God is reminding him Have you noticed how God said, remember when you ran away from Esau and you came to Bethel and I showed up? Well, I'm the same God now, and it's been 20 years. Go back to Bethel, live there. I'll meet you there. I am the same God who talked to you when you were leaving. Now you're coming back. And oh yeah, you remember the whole 10% part, right? So Jacob said to his household and to all that were with him, put away your foreign gods, which are among you, and purify yourselves, and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and has been with me wherever I have gone. I think it's interesting to watch the transition as Moses is writing this, remembering that Moses has a whole lot of detail he could work with. The particular things that he writes and the order that he puts them in verse 30 of the previous chapter, you just saw Jacob saying, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, my men are few in number, so they're going to come and gather against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and all my household. Now he's going to that same household and saying to them, purify yourself, put on clean garments, put away your foreign gods. We're going to go build an altar to God who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. Listen to the faith that he is now exemplifying because he's heard from God. And the transition went from, I'm going to be destroyed and my enemies are going to get me, to God showing up and saying, I'm still the same God that talked to you at Bethel 20 years ago. And then he goes to his household and says, oh yeah, that's right, I forgot. God's faithful. And he's been with me the whole time. He's been with me the whole way. So was it Jacob's own fleshly faithfulness, him kind of observing God's batting average and then saying, well, yes, good old God. It turns out that he's really done a pretty good job. I guess I'll make him my God and I'll let him continue to be the Lord of my life. Well, you see none of that here. What you see is God being faithful to Jacob despite Jacob's faithlessness, and God showing up again and again and saying, I'm still God, and I'm still here, and I'm still taking care of you. And then you see Jacob express his response to the fact that God has been faithful. And that is consistent all the way through the Bible, and I think anybody who's being honest with themselves would say that that is consistent with their own life, that our tendency is toward faithlessness. Our tendency is toward, where's God now? Oh no, I'm going to be destroyed. My enemies are going to get me. Then you go back to his word and you start reading again and you start finding out that God is faithful and that his promises are good and that he's consistent. And that's what actually builds up our faith. Our faith is not built up by our willingness or our running hard or our exercising ourselves or by the exercise of religious practice. That does not build up faith. Faith is built when you hear from God.
Under distress, especially.
Especially under distress, faith is built when you hear from God. Going back to his word, that's why I just keep pounding his word and pounding his word, is that the more you find out about the faithfulness of God and the more you understand that he has your best interest in mind, then your faith in him is built up again. Paul talks frequently about the fact that the troubles of this life, the struggles of this life, create in us a patience, a triedness, and that patience that comes through going through trouble and trials in this life produces hope. And hope, says Paul, does not make anyone ashamed. That word hope is that confident expectation that the same God who's done it before is going to do it again. And after you go through enough trials in this life and then you see yourself delivered through those trials, the more faith you have when you go toward the next trial, because you know that that's the same God who took you through the last trial. Well, that's what God's doing here. He's saying, remember when you were running from your brother? I met you at Bethel. Now here you are running from the Canaanites and the Perizzites, thinking they're going to destroy you. I'm the same God. I delivered you 20 years ago. I'm the same God I'll deliver you today. I'm faithful. And so then he's able to go out and extol the virtues of God and talk about the God who has been with him the whole time. He forgot that. You see it a lot where Jacob just forgets that God's with him and worries about his life and worries about his flesh and worries about whether his enemies are going to get him. And it is not his strength or willfulness or intrinsic humanness that restores him. It is always God that restores him. And this is consistent in the whole Bible. For instance, one of the most consistent personality profiles that we get in the New Testament is that of Peter. And what we see of Peter consistently is that he's always saying the wrong thing, open mouth, insert foot, spends a lot of time with sandals in his mouth. Peter's always the one saying and doing the wrong thing. And we can look at it again and again in the Bible and see Peter misstepping. And every single time that Peter missteps, you can read right behind it how Jesus restores him. It's always Peter doing the wrong thing, and it's always Christ doing the right thing. And you never, ever once read a story about Peter where Peter missteps, makes a mistake, even so far as denying the Lord, swearing, cussing like the old fisherman he was, and denying he ever knew Jesus to save his own hide. Never once do you see Peter ever restore himself. You never see any of the gospel writers say, and then Peter came back to himself and went, oh my goodness, what a mistake I've made. I must correct myself immediately. You don't see any of that. Instead, every time he slips, I'll give you the most classic example. I've used this example many times, but when Jesus has the conversation with Peter and says, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you like wheat. And the reason I bring that up frequently is because I think that's perhaps the most frightening statement that Jesus made during his time on earth. When Jesus says to a human being, I've had a conversation with Satan, and he knows that scripturally he gets somebody, because he knows it's prophesied that the one that breaks bread at my table is also going to put his hand toward betraying me. So Satan knows the scripture well enough to know he gets one of you, and based on your performance so far, Peter, Satan seems to think it's you. And Satan has desired to have you. And then that very chilling phrase, to sift you like wheat. So Peter's performance to this moment has led even Satan to say, this guy's a goner. There's no way this guy is going to make it all the way to heaven. I'm going to get this guy. I'm going to eat him up and spit him out. I get him. And the next thing Jesus says is, but I have prayed for you that your faith fail not. Did he say, Peter, Satan's desired to have you. Now pray. Satan's desired to have you. Join a church, get busy, get on a committee, get to work. The only thing that was going to save Peter from the destruction Satan intended for him was if Jesus interceded. And boy, what a comfort it had to be to Peter when Jesus said, I prayed for you that your faith won't fail. And you see that consistently. Three times Peter denied him. And then after the resurrection, Jesus shows up on the seashore and three times says to that same Peter, do you love me? I mean, it's always Jesus that's doing the restoring. It's always we humans that are doing the tripping up, the messing up. That's why I love the fact that the gospel writers were so forthcoming in their stories about Peter, because we can all relate. I can't relate to Nathanael, because when he shows up, Jesus says, behold, an Israelite indeed in whom there is no guile. I cannot relate to this. I don't know what it is like to think of myself as having no guile, to be pure in my intentions and thoughts and not trying to trip anybody. No, I can relate to Peter. Peter, I got that one down. I've got the whole tripping up, messing up, put your foot in mouth. I can do that. So I'm really glad to see that it was never up to Peter to sustain himself. But again, this is consistent biblically, and we see it back here with Jacob. Jacob continues to be heel catcher, supplanter, following his own way, having no faith in God, believing that his enemies are going to get him despite the promise of God. It is God that shows up and says, I am the same God who met you before at Bethel. I delivered you before. I'm delivering you again. I'm faithful despite you. And that's real good news for us human beings who are not good at always being faithful. Right? You had your hand up for a minute?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that anytime I turn on the TV or I think back on any sermon, it seems like what they always try to do is extol the faith of these people as a basis on which God found them okay. And like that's how you need to be if you're going to be okay.
Okay, well, let's be fair. If you go to Hebrews 11, the Heroes of Faith passage, as it's classically called, yes, the writer of Hebrews, to make the point that without faith it is impossible to please God, I mean, he writes that all these people pleased God by their faith. And the point he's making is that it was not their performance, but that it was their faith that pleased him. But he summarizes at the beginning of chapter 12 by saying, now, since we are surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that does so easily beset us and run that race with patience, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. So he gets the theology very precise and says it is Jesus who is the author and finisher of faith, but it is faith that is pleasing to God as opposed to performance or legalism or any of that stuff. So I'm just giving some of these folks the benefit of the doubt. If I was preaching on faith, the necessity of faith, the gift of faith, and that the only way to please God is with faith, I'm going to go to these guys because that's what chapter 11 of Hebrews does. But I'm also always going to put it in the context of faith is a gift from God and Jesus is the author and finisher of it.
They usually extol faith as a human virtue.
That's where the difference is. Right. They'll say faith is a human virtue and then tell you to get busy and do it.
Right.
I think that takes us to verse 4. Chapter 35, verse 4, so they gave to Jacob all their foreign gods which they had, and the rings which were in their ears. Jacob hid them under the oak that was near Shechem. As they journeyed, there was a great terror upon the cities which were around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. Now, what was Jacob's fear?
That they'd be attacked.
They were all going to come after him. I'm going to be destroyed. God shows up, the same God who had told him 20 years before, I'm going to protect you. And now God has said, come back to Bethel. This is the guy who is carrying the Abrahamic covenant. He must live. He is the seed. He's the lineage. He is the one through whom the Christ is going to come. And so rather than be attacked by all the enemies he was so afraid of, a great fear fell on all those cities, and nobody came out after him because he was being divinely protected by God. Why? Because God is faithful. Are you getting a sense for the God is faithful part yet? Because it's interwoven all the way through these stories. It is always God who is the faithful actor. And he is acting and protecting Jacob, not because Jacob deserved it, not because Jacob said, you know, the Lord is my shield and my great strength, let's go. He was cowering. He was, they're going to get me. It's God that shows up and says, go back to Bethel. I'm going to give you that land. Go there, build an altar, get rid of your foreign gods. As they journeyed, there was a great terror upon the cities which were around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there, and he called the name El Bethel, the God of the house of God, because there God had revealed himself to him when he fled from his brother. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the oak, and it was named Alon Bakuth. In verse 9, then, it says, God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padam Aram, and he blessed him, and God said to him. For those of you keeping count, this is what? Number 9 now? Is this the 9th retelling, Tom?
I think it is.
The Abrahamic covenant being repeated. I was counting on Tom to know because he's been keeping notes all this time. And
no, Mark, we've already done 8.
We've already done 8. This is 9. I was right. The 9th telling of the Abrahamic covenant in the book of Genesis. We are only 35 chapters into the book of Genesis, and for the 9th time, we're going to hear the Abrahamic covenant. That's why I kept saying when we were introducing the book of Genesis that people get all hung up on the creation part of it. And they say, well, what about how many actual days it took to make the heaven and earth? And what about the dinosaurs? Where do they fit in here? Where do they? And they get all hung up on the stuff that Moses blew through in two chapters. Moses did not put the emphasis on how the earth was made. It was God made it. He made it in 7 days. He made it in 6 days. He rested on the seventh day. He made it in this order. And then he just makes this beeline from there to the Abrahamic covenant. And now we're into the ninth telling of the Abrahamic covenant. That is how important Moses saw the Abrahamic covenant to be. So let's put the emphasis in the book of Genesis where the writer put the emphasis. He did not write much at all about the creation because the book of Genesis is not ultimately about the creation. By the way, Moses did not call the first book of the Pentateuch, the five books that he wrote, he didn't call it Genesis. That's a name that was added later by Bible publishers and such because it does start with in the beginning, the Genesis of all things, the creation of things. But Moses did not sit down and write, now the book of Genesis, the creation of all things, the beginning, because the emphasis in Moses, if you just read it, if somebody just gave it to you, you would see, okay, God created everything. That's why he's called the God who made heaven and earth. And here he's said to have made heaven and earth. But you see that the emphasis moves real fast through. And then there were seven generations. And then there was Noah. And then there was a flood. And then after the flood, there were people and they scattered out. And then God went to Abraham and Ur of the Chaldees. And all of a sudden it goes from Evelyn Wood's speed reading. The whole book slows down, takes its time, and starts talking about the Abrahamic covenant. Because the Abrahamic covenant is just so essential, it's such bedrock material to the whole rest of the Bible, that even the new covenant is based on the Abrahamic covenant. And if you see the Old Testament through sedological eyes, thank you very much. That's two new words tonight I've made up. If you start looking at the Bible through that seedology kind of view where you're just tracing the Abrahamic covenant and where it's going, then when you get to the beginning of the New Testament and the New Covenant and you see the New Covenant, another unconditional covenant come about, it seems completely familiar to you. You go, well, of course God would do that. And then when Paul in Galatians says that the law came and left, but it did not in any way annul the covenant God made with Abraham 430 years earlier, you go, oh, well, that theology fits perfectly with everything I've read so far. Remember that the writers of the New Testament were Jews. They were familiar with all this stuff and the original emphasis of this stuff. And the original emphasis is on God keeping covenant with particular people. And so when God sends his son, and somebody says to you, the son came to save particular people, you have a problem with that. Well, yeah, that's the way God's always worked. From the moment he said, in Isaac shall your seed be called, even though Isaac was the second born, from that point forward, God became particular. When I say God doesn't just love you in a wide, broad, indiscriminate way, but he loves you with a particularity that allowed him to write your name down in a book before the foundation of the world, that doesn't seem foreign to anybody who knows their Old Testament. They're going to say, yes, the way God's always been. From the minute he said, in Isaac your seed will be called. Jacob I've loved, Esau have I hated. I'm going to skip over everybody and go down to Joseph and then go to his youngest son and give him the covenant. We go, well, that's the way God's always worked. And then you read that Jesus came and said, I lay down my life for the sheep. And then says to the Pharisees, you're not of my sheep. We understand that kind of particularity. That's the way that God has always, always been. And that's why this early theology in the book of Genesis is so foundational. And so here we go, the ninth telling of the Abrahamic covenant. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram, and he blessed him, and God said to him, your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. Thus he called him Israel. God also said to him, I am God Almighty. Proper name. Almighty. I know this seems kind of obvious, but I'm going to say it again because people get this wrong constantly. If God has all power, if he is indeed almighty, Is there any other power or might left over somewhere?
No.
There just can't be. You're talking about the God, remember, who made everything and who knows everything, who does everything according to his own plan and purpose, the God who sits on his throne and does whatever he pleases, and then he gives himself the name, the revelatory name, I am God who has all the power. Do you think when he said that, that he could have been aware of some other tangential power out there somewhere in his universe that he just chose not to mention? On some distant planet, on some distant star somewhere, there is some guy with some power, but we just won't mention him. No, he said, I'm the God who has all the power. What is he trying to tell you at that moment? Well, yes, there's no free will. That would be a good start.
It never occurred to me until you just said it that way, that free will is a form of power that people covet.
Yes.
And that is what they get so offended
sure.
about.
Yes.
Because that really is like a magical thing where you can exert God's favor.
Mm-hmm.
It never occurred to me.
You control God by getting him to do what you want him to do if you say the formula. So you have the power, right?
Yes.
So is it... Are you a Christian if you believe that you exercised your power to save you?
Yes, you can be.
I don't even want to go down that road. You know, because now you're asking, are you a Christian? Can you believe?
That theology.
Well, I have a... Let me
is say, that theology biblical? No, that theology is not biblical.
Is that theology able to save?
Is that theology able to save? If I go with Paul, I have to say no. Because he went so far as to say, if any man preach anything other than what you've received, let him be accursed. Now, he couldn't say that if it was, well, it's a slightly different theology, but it does save. Then he couldn't say these need to be accursed for preaching it. So, no, I don't believe it is a theology that can ultimately save. But having said that, theology doesn't save. God does. Can God save people who are theologically confused? Sure, because salvation is in the finished work of his son. And so, go ahead.
I had a little inspiration reading through this last week.
Were you reading ahead again?
No, this was no. But anyhow, he was talking about Abraham's salvation. And it said because of his faith, Abraham believed God.
And God counted it for righteousness.
And God counted it for righteousness.
Right.
And he wasn't circumcised until years later.
Right.
So that gives yes. God room to save anybody who believes.
Yes. That also gives God room to give faith, since faith is a gift, that Jesus is the author and finisher of faith. You're saved by grace through faith, and that not of yourself. It is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. That means that God can give faith and exchange that for righteousness to anybody he chooses to save. But having said that, there also has to be faith involved, and that faith is faith in the finished work of Christ.
Well, and so, God, their justification for saving right.
And the reason that's such good news, Glass, let's expand on that for a little bit, because Jennifer and I have talked about this before at some length. The great part of the realization that God saves by grace, based on the finished work of his son and not anything within us, so that we don't start getting arrogant and thinking, well, I got saved because I had my theology right, or I got saved because I had all my doctrine straight and I dotted every I and crossed every T. The great part about him being able to save anybody is that he can save a child who is never going to be able to comprehend faith or who Jesus is, because it's not based on the person, it's based on God's grace. He can save a person who went to Vietnam and, you know, took a bullet to the head and hasn't known who he is since. God is still able to save that man because it's not based on his ability to comprehend God. It's based on God being faithful to the finished work of his son.
Well, isn't all of that based on the fact that Satan could accuse God of being unjust? And because Christ made such a sacrifice of himself, Satan has nothing else to say. Mm-hmm. He has to declare God just and give him faith to whomever he chooses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when it says that the judge of all the earth will do right, then I got to go with that and say whatever God does is right and is just. Because, again, it is based
right,
on it is based on a payment. It is based on a price. A price has been paid. His wrath has been satisfied.
Right. All sin has to be
paid has to be paid for.
And yeah. Satan evidently is not going to argue about the price that
Yeah. That Christ was sufficient. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so now that we've said all that, God can do all that because he has all the power, and he can do it for particular people because he's always been particular. So our theology and our doctrine continues to be completely biblical, and thank God for that kind of grace. Pardon me?
And completely individual.
Completely individual, absolutely, sure. But well, that comes into God's absolute complete knowledge. Right. He can deal with any individual personally. Yes, ma'am.
It is hard for me to wrap around that somebody that feels that their salvation is based on their works, as sincere as they are about their love for God, as sincere as they are, mm-hmm. Still living like a Pharisee, thinking that everything, you know, that what their works are going to save them.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to believe that God would reveal to them what they really are, so that they would see God's grace. And it's just, I know God can do it, and I, you know, understand all that, people on the cross, all that. It just seems like it would be
awful hard for God to do that.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it would. I just don't think that that's the norm.
Well, I think there's two things there. I think number one, when you say they're Pharisees, but they have a great love for God, as an outsider, you're looking at them and saying, what I see is I see that they love God and I see that they're legalistic and I don't know how to make that work.
Yes.
Well, fortunately, you're talking about a God who knows them, knows their heart. And yet, why God doesn't reveal the truth to them, I end up taking a hard line. And it's unfortunate, but I end up going back to Jesus walking around saying, I speak in parables to them so that they'll hear and not understand.
Jim, I believe God saved me in 1973, but until I started talking to him, I did not lie. But see, that's the answer to your question, Jennifer. Did God save you all before you got this right?
No, exactly.
No, think about it. He did.
No. My qualm is not with the individual person who is sitting in the mega church listening to that theology. My qualm is with the mega church preaching that theology.
Yes.
Is that a theology that is a legitimate preaching of the gospel?
No, it's not a legitimate preaching of the gospel, but there are saved people in there, most likely, because I was one of them.
Oh, yes.
I was saved
from a cult.
I objected strenuously to the real teaching of the gospel because I had unlearned the way I was saved previously. I was saved in 73, and then I went to Lipscomb, and then I started thinking, oh, well, you're saved because you're, you don't realize it, but your thinking shifts, and you're saved because you're a good person. But all the while, I was saved even with my incorrect theology.
Yeah, absolutely. God loved you just as much then as he does now.
Right. And now he decided to reveal to me after I turned 50. And I say, well, why didn't you let me know it then so I could really have been a terrorist at Lipscomb? Well, God obviously is smarter than me.
I know. But there was a purpose.
So, theologically, it's not something you can preach.
Here's my problem. And here's what I've always... It's like, you know, we're sitting here in this little church. Okay, so when I meet people who go to the mega churches and they spew their lovely theology at me, I have a tough time telling them, you know, it's, oh yeah, that's good. I can't tell them that. I can't say, oh, okay, I love Joyce Myers. I love Beth Moore. I have to say, you know, that's really not biblical.
So we have to assume that God knows what he's doing and leave it up to him to sort out who is and who isn't. I'll tell you, if we were to be strictly Pauline and take as hard a line as Paul takes, we would stand up against those people and say, I'm sorry, you have a doctrine that doesn't save, you got a gospel that isn't a gospel, there's no good news in what you teach because it's all what you got to do, and you're not capable of doing the very things you say you got to do. There is no good news in that.
I do say that.
I do too.
And I get in trouble.
And that's why we're so popular. So, okay, let's get through this. Chapter 35, verse 10, God said to him, your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. Thus he called him Israel. God also said to him, I am God Almighty. I had a bunch of stuff I wanted to say about that, but I never got to it. So we're just going to keep moving. I know, I'm looking for sympathy. That's all I'm looking for.
Say just the good stuff. All
right.
You want me to just edit through everything and just say the good stuff?
All right, just give us 1, 2, 3.
It's real easy. If God calls himself by a proper name that includes, I have all the power, it is axiomatic that that means there is no other power left over somewhere else. That means that whatever power you see anywhere in the universe exercised by anyone to any degree, it is God who is the motivation and who is the force, the instigator behind that power. If you are taking a breath right now, it is the power of God that is giving you the ability to breathe. If you know your own name, having cogent thoughts, and the synapses are still snapping, it's because God has empowered you to live and breathe and know another thing for another moment. Whatever you are doing, it is God who is empowering it. And to whatever degree you want to argue about it and say, no, God is not empowering this particular thing, to that degree you have to say God is not all powerful. He is only mostly powerful. He's not almighty. He's mostly mighty. But he doesn't describe himself that way. God himself describes himself. And this is very, very helpful. Any time in the Bible that you get God describing himself and saying, let me tell you what I'm like, pay attention, because that's really, really helpful when God says, I'm like this.
This is life eternal, that you know me.
That you know me, absolutely. You know the Father, you know the one that he sent. This is life eternal. So he says, I am God, I am Almighty. Now, here's where it gets a little more complicated. So then what about Satan and the things that Satan did and the deception that happened with Judas? Or what about the fall of man? What about Adam? What about sin in the world? Did those things happen by surprise? Or are they all part of the master plan of the one who is almighty? Now, if you know that everything that happens, everything that occurs, is in the hand of the one who empowers everything that happens, then it just is easier to deal with what happens. Because you know that the Almighty One empowered it. Nothing, nothing, nothing reaches you that God doesn't empower, allow, decree. There's a phrase I heard years ago that an old preacher used that I just always liked the phrase. He said, nothing ever got to you that didn't first pass through nail-scarred hands. And that's good to know. That's good to hold on to, because in this life, a lot of bad stuff, terrifying stuff, awful stuff, painful stuff happens. And it's real good to know that it actually serves a purpose. I can prove it this way. The worst thing that happened in the garden was that the man with the freest will, who had access to the tree of life and could have lived happily forever in God's presence, only one restriction against his will, and he did that thing. Now that plunged all of mankind into darkness and depravity and sin, the end result of which is the Son of God, who was the Lamb slain before the foundation of the world, is going to end up with all the glory and all the honor, and every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father, and through eternal ages all the saints and angels in heaven are going to sing to the glory of the Son because of the sacrifice that he gave to redeem the people of God. That is the most magnificent end result anybody could imagine, and it happened because of the terrible thing that happened when the man fell. See, there's plan there. There's purpose to that. I'm sure all of us who have lived long enough can say that stuff that happened in our life that was bad, that was difficult, that was problematic, those are also the key places where we learned the most and grew up the most and got closer to God. You pray a lot more heartfelt prayers when you're in trouble than you do when you're comfortable. When things are going good, it's much easier to take God for granted. But when you're in trouble, you don't take God for granted. You're on your knees all the time. God help me. God knows that. He uses the trouble and the problems and everything to draw you to himself, because he is God Almighty. He is empowering not just some of the stuff, not just the good stuff. He is empowering all the stuff that happens in his universe. So things don't happen by accident. They happen by the one who has all the power. And if you can argue any other philosophy or theology, then you got to get God to change his name. You say, okay, God, sorry, but you're God pretty powerful. You're God mostly mighty. But if he describes himself and gives himself the proper name, I'm God who has all the might, then there is no other might, there is no other power, it's all him. Therefore, all the glory will, of course, naturally redound to him. All the worship will be pointed toward him, and the culmination of all human life and the events of the universe culminate in the glory of God, because he has all the power. That's the way he designed it. That's what he's up to. That's what he's doing. And you can't stop him because he has all the power.
You don't think Satan has power?
If Satan has some power that is actually Satan's, I mean intrinsic to Satan.
No, I think it was given to him by God.
It's given to him. And if it's given to him by God, isn't it also controlled by God?
Well.
Limited by God?
Well,
doled out by God?
Yes.
Right, sure. Because we know at the end of the book of Revelation that God's going to put him in the lake of fire.
Right.
If he can do it at the end, why can't he do it now? He can do it any time he wants. So why hasn't he yet? Because to this moment it serves a purpose. The one who has all the power is working out his own purposes, and Satan actually plays into his master plan. And when he's done with Satan, he's going to put him in the lake of fire because he doesn't need him anymore. But as long as the plan is at work, then Satan still has a place because the Almighty is at work. I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you. Where else did we hear that?
Abraham
and Isaac were both told. Nations and companies of nations are coming out of you. Now it's passed down to the next generation. Out of you. This is that seed delineating which of the sons. Kings shall come forth from you. And the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give it to you. Is there any part of the Abrahamic covenant that's not being included here? And I will give the land to your descendants after you. There it is, the Abrahamic covenant passed on from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob completely. So you have to understand that God is capable and willing and has practiced and demonstrated his ability and his will and his desire to pass the Abrahamic covenant along. Therefore, Paul could say in the book of Galatians that that covenant was still alive and well, doing fine, hadn't been annulled, nothing changed. God is still in the activity of being in covenant with particular people. It's the way he's always been. Got that? Okay, we'll stop right there. We'll start at verse 13. Somebody mark your Bible. Then God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him. And we'll pick up there. Any questions about all that? Any questions? Jennifer rolled her eyes like, any questions? We were talking just earlier, before we started tonight, Alex and I were talking about this land thing and how important this land thing is.
I'm just seeing it.
Again.
I can see why you, I mean, when you would say all that, I mean, this is the very link that he's offering.
The land is the link.
The biggest link. It's not like a throw-in. It is the essence of the promise.
Right.
And it's not to Judah, it's to Ephraim.
Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to where those promises go. But that's why I'm being so pedagogical about saying it goes to particular people, particular men are carrying the promise, because later when it goes to particular men, we have to know which particular men it's gone to, because it has to be fulfilled in the people who are particularly carrying the promise. And when you get to the New Testament and start saying that the land has been done away with or been spiritualized or it's a type of heaven or whatever else, you are undermining.
You've made that of all of it.
Exactly. You've made a mess of all of it, because the land is the core and the essence of the Abrahamic covenant. And as long as the covenant is still alive and well, so is the land promise. You can't get rid of it.
God, but in the many of the prophecies, he'd say, prophesy to the hills of Judah. Prophesy to the mountains of Israel.
The land is important.
The prophecy is landed right there in that geography.
Right there. Right. Why do you think the heavenly city that comes down is called New Jerusalem? I would think that'd be a clue. I would think anybody would go, well, it has the word Jerusalem right in it. And the gates have the names of the 12 tribes on them. Huh. And the walls and the foundations have the names of the apostles. 12 of them. It all kind of fits.
Jesus told the apostles they would sit on thrones judging.
Judging the 12 tribes. So there need to be 12 tribes. Yeah, exactly right. And there's 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. Gee, it just all kind of keeps coming up, doesn't it? Well, then if there's that much detail that is carried over into the New Testament and Paul is still arguing for the continuity of the Abrahamic covenant, then the foundation of it, the land, has to continue to be a part of it, because that is what defines it.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.